I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. 10-year-old Sarah Murnahan is recovering from a double lung transplant performed at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia on June 12th. Her case received national attention because of her family's fight to lift the age restriction on lung transplantation. She was suffering from end-stage cystic fibrosis, and children were barred from receiving adult lungs. A judge lifted that restriction for her and for an 11-year-old boy named Javier Acosta, and shortly after that, Sarah had the lung transplant. In this hour of Radio Times, we want to examine some of the ethical issues this case raises about organ donation, why there's a shortage, and what can be done about it. And we have a guest who has joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. His name is Scott Halpern. He's a medical ethicist and assistant professor of medicine, medical ethics, health policy, and epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And Scott Halpern, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Let me begin by saying that if I were Sarah's mother, I would do everything under the sun to try to get a lung transplant for my daughter. So I don't want anyone to think that we are in any way criticizing what the family did to try to and successfully to get a lung transplant for
I couldn't agree more. As the father of two young girls, I can only imagine the agony that this family has been going through and is still going through. And they did exactly what loving parents do. They fight for their children. They have duties to their children, and they adhered to those duties as best they could. This is a situation where judges and political leaders did not adhere to their duties to promote the interests of all potential patients.
Well, let me pick up on that. And there was a judge who essentially lifted the restrictions for these two children. What did the judge do wrong from your perspective?
Well, the judge's intervention in issuing a restraining order against the Department of Health and Human Services from implementing a national policy sets a particularly troubling precedent. First of all, the decision was made without careful consideration of the many medical facts and circumstances that would weigh importantly in determining whether the claim about age discrimination had any merit whatsoever.
And that's what the family was claiming.
It's certainly what the family was claiming, and it's certainly what Steve Harvey, the attorney who was representing the family, argued articulately in front of Judge Bailson.
And because we're talking about a national policy, he obviously, made an exception for these two children?
That's right. So by issuing a restraining order, that resulted in the two children being given equal priority for adult lungs, whereas the policy had been in place since 2010 in a specific effort to promote equity or fairness in how lungs are distributed. It's important to recognize that there are three goals in distributing lungs. One is to generate the most good for the most people. A second is to make sure that people who have equal claims on lungs are given equal opportunities to receive them, a principle of fairness. And then third, that we treat people who are the worst off to begin with a little extra priority. And in fact, that policy would, if anything, tend to give children priority because it prevents adults or adolescents who are just a little bit above 12 from accessing the very short supply of children's lungs.
But so are you saying that the judge ruled incorrectly in this case?
Well, I would say that the judge ruled imprudently. The situation is – so what the attorney, Mr. Harvey, argued, and I think appropriately, was that we don't have all the medical facts that we would want, and that to acquire those facts would require weeks, if not months. On both those counts, he was correct. Mm-hmm. Additionally, he was correct that if we maintain the policy, if we don't issue the restraining order, then there's a chance that as we're acquiring those data, Sarah or Javier could die. Where Mr. Harvey and ultimately Judge Bailson made a fundamental error is by then concluding that there was no countervailing claim that was equally important to maintain the policy or to not suspend it. And this is problematic for a couple reasons, the most fundamental of which is that when Sarah got her lungs, that meant in no uncertain terms that someone else would not. And so the judge's decision effectively means that either they were unaware of that trade-off between one patient or another, or that they were making some claim that Sarah's life was more important than someone else's.
I want to pick up on that, but I also want to pick up on something you said earlier about elected officials. I know Senator Toomey, I'm not sure who else got involved in this case, but does that trouble you as well?
Well, it doesn't trouble me in principle that elected officials would get involved in difficult circumstances. It does trouble me to some extent that this particular family, who again was doing everything that loving families would do, but they happened to be very well connected to public relations firms who were able to really guide them in using social media, the internet, and other forms of communication much to their advantage. And it was only through that, because they were able to generate such a big media storm, that elected politicians got involved. And I don't think that the elected politicians, Mr. Toomey and others, took the appropriate time to carefully consider multiple sides of this complicated story.
What are the risks of transplanting an adult lung into a child?
Well, one of the unfortunate truths is that we don't have this data on that question that we would ideally have. We certainly know that lung transplantation in kids is a very rare phenomenon. There are only 20 kids on the waiting list in Sarah's age group in the entire country right now. Those are listed at only 5 centers. So it's not like anyone has a tremendous amount of experience with this procedure. Having said that, some children do quite well with the procedure. So we certainly don't want to prevent children from getting lungs. The question is, to what degree should we prioritize them?
And for what we know about Sarah, she was described as end-stage cystic fibrosis. So she was she dying as a result of cystic fibrosis?
Undoubtedly. She had been on the wait list for some time, I understand more than a year. And in recent months and weeks, certainly leading up to the decision, she was getting progressively worse, to the point that a reasonable physician might have deemed her unlikely to live more than a few weeks or months.
And looking at transplantation policy, broadly speaking, those people who are at greater risk move to the top of the line?
Well, that's true for adults. That's exactly how adults are prioritized once they're on the list. There are two key factors. Well, I should start by saying first one has to meet eligibility to be put on the list. So the very, very old, or people who aren't deemed to have the proper resources, social support, family support to get through a complicated lung transplant, or people with other illnesses which may impact their survival regardless of how their lungs do, will not be put on the list. And then once on the list, adults are prioritized based on their likelihood of dying without a transplant and their likelihood of living if they do get a transplant. And those factors of urgency and potential benefit are how adults get prioritized.
How about for children?
So children's a little bit different. It was considered that using those exact same criteria for children might not work in the intended fashion, precisely because we don't have enough evidence about, you know, to develop good prediction models of how people would do without a transplant or how they would do with a transplant. So it was decided that instead, because we want children to have access to lungs, but we don't want to make mistakes, that we want to give children special access to lungs that are most likely to fit their small bodies.
Literally. And so you're talking about juvenile lungs then?
Right. So children have absolute priority to lungs from other children. Adults have priority to adults for lungs from adult donors. And the policy that's been called into question is one that tries to keep those two camps as separate as is reasonable, to prevent adults from accessing children's lungs, which would happen much, much more commonly without the policy than children accessing adult lungs.
Is that your worry?
Well, I think it's one reasonable concern, and it is one reason that the policy was put into place, that absent the policy, someone who's just a little older than 12 or someone who's just a little bit taller than your average child could benefit certainly from lungs from childhood donors. And then children on the waiting list, albeit very few of them, would have potentially no access at all.
Does anyone know about Javier Acosta? He's the 11-year-old boy that was included in this judge's decision.
That's right. So my understanding is that Javier is still at the Children's Hospital. He's not quite as sick as Sarah was at the time of the judicial intervention.
What do you think about the role of the media? And, of course, media is broadly speaking, you had mentioned social media, and I think the family used that very effectively to get their message out. But I know that there's a part of the media that, loves these rescue stories, these stories of heartbreak and children. I mean, it sort of meets a certain criteria in a certain segment of the media.
Right. So I think the media has a tremendous role to play in bringing issues to light in ways that they might not otherwise be brought to light. I think this media attention can do a tremendous amount of good by encouraging more people to become organ donors. I think this media attention can do a tremendous amount of good by encouraging transplant physicians and other members of the transplant community to really reassess what we're doing and to reevaluate whether there aren't ways that we could be increasing the supply of organs more effectively and ways that we could improve the distribution of the organs that are available. What concerns me is that by allowing the huge media storm that surrounded this case to influence policy, we're basically setting a precedent where people who have the greatest resources to access the media or to access judges or politicians, those who can, for lack of a better term, shout the loudest, mm-hmm. are going to be prioritized relative to those with fewer resources. And I don't think most of us want that to happen, for that to be the way that we allocate organs.
And are we having this conversation because there's such a critical shortage of organs?
Undoubtedly. So right now,
if we had a lot of organs, then the problem would be just matching people with the correct organ.
That's exactly right. And hopefully someday there will be a technological solution to this ethical problem. But at least for now, there simply are not enough to go around. Presently, there are about 1,300 people waiting for lung transplant actively on the wait list. And in fact, that grossly underrepresents the number of people who could benefit. There are certainly far more people who could benefit from transplant who are not on the list, either because we know lungs are so scarce or because we just don't think that the relative benefits for those people are as great.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Scott Halpern. He's a medical ethicist. He's a pulmonary physician as well. And I wrote a piece that was published yesterday in the Annals of Internal Medicine titled Turning Wrong into Right, the 2013 Lung Allocation, written in part about this story of a young girl here in the Philadelphia area and her family's fight to lift the age restriction when it comes to lung transplantation. We want to know what you think about what we're talking about. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we have a guest waiting in the wings to talk about her lung transplant. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn's Department of Dermatology supports WHYY. Do you have moderate to severe psoriasis? You may be eligible to receive up to 1 year of treatment covered by the VIP study. Penn is conducting a psoriasis research study to determine if FDA-approved treatments such as Humira and phototherapy improve cutting-edge markers of cardiovascular disease. To see if you or someone you know qualifies, the number is 215-662-SKIN. 215-662-SKIN.
Only 5 days left until WHYY's fiscal year ends. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne. As WHYY comes to the end of our fiscal year, think of how your favorite public radio station has made a difference in your life. Now you can make a difference with your pledge of support. Pledge online at WHYY.org. When you call, speak with a volunteer about becoming a sustaining member of WHYY so we can invest more of your support into the programs you love. Visit WHYY.org. And thanks.
This Week in This American Life. If you're in the country illegally, why show up at a Border Patrol station?
What's your job?
It's enforcing immigration laws. What's it to you?
I'm illegal, too.
Oh, you're illegal?
So you think I should get deported?
I don't know. Why don't you show us some ID?
Why getting arrested was his plan all along. This week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Scott Halpern. He's a medical ethicist, also assistant professor of medicine, medical ethics, health policy, and epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And joining us now is Kathy Clapham. She's a lung transplant recipient. In fact, that happened when she was 34 years old after cystic fibrosis was destroying her lung. She's become an advocate for organ donation and volunteers with Gift for Life. And Kathy Clapham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. I know you were listening in on our conversation, but let me ask you a couple of questions about yourself. How many years ago did you have your lung transplant?
So this May, it was just 7 years ago.
And how are you feeling these days?
I feel incredibly awesome. I am back up and better than I ever was before. I have cystic fibrosis as well.
And describe, I guess, the before and after for our listeners.
Well, my whole life, I was obviously born with cystic fibrosis, and in my family, I had a sister and brother that did pass away of it before the age of five. So my family was very familiar with the disease, cystic fibrosis. But when I was born, which was in 1971, a lot more therapies had come into play, a lot more. Understanding of the disease, and I, handled it quite well throughout my life. I was able to do pretty much what I wanted to do. When I was in my early 30s, I became pregnant, and pregnancy with women with cystic fibrosis is becoming more and more common. It was not necessarily, a bad outcome. Lots of people had gone through it and been successful and had successful pregnancies and labor and deliveries. However, I was thrown a loophole. I was pregnant with twins.
Oh, wow.
So that obviously was a little bit more than we had expected. So what happened was the twin pregnancy was very difficult for me to withstand for my body. My nutritional needs were not being met because of the cystic fibrosis and the numerous infections that I was encountering. My body was very vulnerable. And basically, by the time I was 26 weeks, they had to deliver my terms, preterm. And they were both born at under 2 pounds each, but they had to deliver them to save my life as well as the baby's lives. So after that, I was pretty much left a shell of my former self. I mean, cystic fibrosis had taken everything from me. My lung capacity was down in the 20s. I was on oxygen. I had to have feeding tubes. I needed outside help for my babies. I couldn't do it. I was very, very weak and very, very malnourished. So everything that cystic fibrosis could do, it did to me. Definitely an end stage.
Do you know who your donor was?
No, we do not.
But it obviously was successful. It's a complicated operation, is it not, Kathy?
It is very complicated. And as the doctor before me kind of indicated, I mean, you go through a lengthy process. And in essence, they want to test every part of you psychologically, your health, your physical health, your mental health. They want to make sure that, of course, you're sick enough to need this, but you can go through it as well because it's a rigorous, rigorous surgery. I mean, I was on the table for 8 hours.
Wow. And how long would you say it took before you began to feel better and just much more functional than you were?
Oh, for me, I had a remarkable outcome. I mean, they had me off the breathing tube within a day. I was walking the halls. I mean, I had some chest tubes. I was definitely, a little worse for the wear from the surgery. But in terms of breathing, it was remarkable how fast I didn't need oxygen. I could immediately just feel the difference. And the thing with the lung transplant, I mean, every day for about a good year, I was just gaining more and more lung function because those lungs are just working, and I was exercising and doing all the things that you're supposed to do, and it all went as perfect as it could for me. I mean, there's always little bumps in the road,
sure,
but they could handle that.
Scott, you want to weigh in on this? I mean, we're hearing Kathy talking about her lung transplant.
Well, it's just remarkable, and Kathy, congrats to you. You've certainly had a great outcome, as you described, and as she alluded to, getting off the breathing tube in a day certainly happens. In fact, it happens for more than 50% of people after they get a lung transplant. And Kathy has already exceeded, you know, the average life expectancy following a lung transplant. So you keep going. Certainly not all patients are the same, and not all surgeries are the same. So there is certainly a lot of variability in how well the procedure works.
And Kathy, how are your kids doing?
Oh, they're wonderful. They're 9 years old. They keep me going. They keep me busy. I'm always on the run with them, and you know, they're remarkable kids. They've overcome all their prematurity issues. We've had a long road, but it's been a very satisfying road, and we're here to tell the story.
Did you, before you had your lung transplant, did you think about transplantation, or did you think about organ donation? Was that even a part of your thinking at all?
Well, you know, having cystic fibrosis, you know, through the years, you'd start to hear. I remember hearing the first, at first, some of them, they did a heart-lung, double lung transplant, and I think it was a cystic fibrosis. It wasn't the first heart-lung, but I remember reading about a heart-lung that was a cystic fibrosis patient, and then you'd hear here, and then I'd meet somebody. But, you know, of course, human nature, you never think that's going to be you. You think, okay, that might be in the future, but who knows, you know, I'm living my life. But when I was pregnant, and I was actually down at University of Penn, and I was in, like I said, I was in the end-stage lung disease ward, I mean, when I was pregnant, and they were telling me that if I got through this labor and delivered these twins, I needed to get on that list because the damage of my lungs was so, so bad. So I hadn't really thought about it, but once that was brought up to me, I was like, okay, let's do it. I have these babies. I've worked hard to get these babies here, and I got to live. I have to raise them, so I'll do whatever it takes.
Scott, let me get you back in on the conversation. I was reading somewhere that it looks like almost like 90% of the population, you know, believes that organ donation is a good thing, is a positive thing, but only about half of the population, or a little bit less than half of the population, have, you know, either filled out a card or put it on their driver's license. A bit of a disconnect there.
Yeah, there certainly is. I think most people do, as you said, think donation is a good thing. There certainly are some people who have some concerns. I think some of those concerns are based on some, you know, misconceptions about what it really means and what it really entails. Certainly, there are a lot of strategies that people have considered to get more people to become organ donors. And just recently, perhaps the most successful has been to enable people on Facebook to become organ donors through their Facebook page, has markedly increased the number of people. So it suggests to me that, exactly as you said, a lot of people want to become donors, but they get stuck in inertia and they procrastinate. But when it's made easier for them, as it was through Facebook, they're happy to do it.
And what were the concerns? What are the concerns that people have about donation?
Well, some people are worried that they might be treated differently if they sign up to be an organ donor, such that near the times of their death, they might not get the same treatment as if they weren't an organ donor. As someone who works in an intensive care unit and understands, you know, just how sick people can be and how care at the end of life proceeds, I hope people can be assured that that couldn't be further from the truth. But those concerns persist. Some people are concerned about, you know, just the need to sort of go to heaven with what they started with. And those are some beliefs that perhaps we'll never overcome. But certainly there's room for improvement.
Kathy, you want to add to that? I'm curious, in your work, what have you found that works to get people to think more proactively about organ donation?
That's why you often go out as a Gift of Life volunteer, and I speak to various organizations, groups, all different ages, all different walks of people. And what Scott mentioned is a number one myth or a misconception people have, so we work to obviously educate them on the process and the benefits. Oftentimes I go out with a donor family member, and their story is more, to me, just so powerful, because they tell the story of probably the most heartbreaking, earth-shattering thing that could ever happen to them in their lives, losing a loved one, oftentimes a son or a daughter, oftentimes a young, very accidental reason. And they talk about that grace and that love for humanity, that they were able to somehow get through their grief and to care for another human being. I mean, they could save up to 6 to 8 people, not to mention with skin and cornea transplantation. So it's an incredible, powerful story on both ends. And, you know, we just work to overcome those myths and misconceptions. I mean, in our life, people have a hard time talking about death as it is. And so this opens that conversation. It's, to me, it's just like when you make your will. You make it, you plan, and then you go on and live your life. And God forbid, you know, anything should happen, your family knows your intentions. Very important. Not only put it on your driver's license, but have that quick conversation with your husband or your wife or your father or mother, whoever it may be. Let them know that this is what I believe in. This is what I feel strongly about. Because in that hour of their moment of grief, that's one less thing they have to think about.
Well, Kathy Clapham, I thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and appreciate your comments on Radio Times today. Thank you so much, and good luck to you as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Kathy Clapham. She's an advocate for organ donation. She volunteers with Gift of Life and received a lung transplant when she was 34 years old, has cystic fibrosis. And we are talking about lung transplantation, organ transplantation, some of the medical ethical issues that are raised, and continuing our conversation with Scott Halpern. Again, he's a medical ethicist and pulmonologist at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And again, wrote this really interesting piece published yesterday in the Annals of Internal Medicine, titled Turning Wrong Into Right, the 2013 Lung Allocation. And we're taking calls. We want to know if you're a donor. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Scott, one of the things that you have talked about is perhaps opening up the possibility of donated organs, donated lungs from people who smoke or have certain health problems, that perhaps it's too restrictive the way organ donation is looked at today.
Right. I think it's a key issue that, you know, we can make sure that the lungs that are available are distributed fairly, but we can also do a lot to increase the supply if transplant centers were more willing to include patients who are awaiting transplantation in the decision-making process about whether to accept an organ or let that organ pass on to someone else. It's complicated, right? So if you're someone who's on a transplant waiting list and you're waiting for an organ, it's a tough decision to say, well, I'll take an organ that might have some blemishes now and reduce the risk that I might not get an organ, or I might choose to wait for that perfect or pristine organ to become available. That's a hard decision-making process. Some people who are sicker might choose to take a sure thing now, and if patients were included in that decision-making process, I think we could have more organs to go around.
And would it be fair to say that the getting the lungs of a smoker is a less than ideal situation just because of what they have done to their lungs?
It's certainly less than ideal. Certainly, we don't want to be using lungs from lifelong heavy smokers, but someone who might have smoked, you know, for 10 years and gave it up 20 years ago, those lungs can often work quite well. Similarly, lungs from people who are a little bit overweight, or lungs from people who might have had, you know, some other imperfections in their health, although not perfect, might be much better than the alternative of no lungs at all for some people. The problem is that transplant centers get scored on their post-transplant outcomes, meaning all transplant centers in the United States get evaluated, and this information is publicly available, on how long their patients live on average. And so you can imagine that in that setting, transplant centers actually are disincentivized from taking riskier organs on behalf of well-informed patients who may really want them. So one way to solve this problem would be to sort of redesign the scoring or quality reporting system so that transplant centers are rewarded rather than penalized for taking chances on behalf of patients.
Are there reasons to have a double lung transplant versus a single lung transplant?
Well, I think that's another really important question. So I think this is a case where well-intending physicians who are trying to promote their individual patients' best interests are putting them on the list to receive two lungs when one would work just as well.
Really?
And this is a case where sort of the traditional medical ethics has been, I need to do everything possible for the patient in front of me, and not to really consider all the other potential patients who might benefit if I made a different decision. And we've really had, the early tide of a sea change in how we think about medical ethics and physicians' responsibilities. We understand the limitations of that system that's based only on primacy or fidelity to my patient. We really need to reconsider that and say that if I'm putting, you know, Mrs. Smith, who's my patient, on for two lungs, there's someone else out there who's not going to get one.
Those are tough. That's a tough decision to make, is it not?
It's very difficult, but we're getting better with figuring out just how well certain patients can do with one lung alone. And increasingly, there's good, robust data to suggest that policies of putting patients with certain diseases, not cystic fibrosis, I should mention, but other diseases like emphysema and pulmonary fibrosis, those patients can do fine by getting just one lung, and that would increase the number of patients who can get a lung without even increasing the overall supply.
What about a piece of a lung? Do you always need a whole lung?
Well, that's another situation where, unfortunately, we just don't have the level of evidence that we'd like. There are some surgeons who've had some success with using pieces of lungs, but it's far from standard of care, and we simply don't know enough right now to sort of recommend that as a fruitful strategy to increase the number of people who can get transplanted.
Let me pick up on something that Kathy was saying and you referenced, which is if you're a physician and you've got a patient who's frankly dying, has organs that could be donated, I'm just thinking about the kind of approach that's both humane to the dying patient and their family, but also, as you said, there's this sort of larger world out there that could benefit from some of these organs.
Right. So I think, there's sort of two ways that people can be declared dead in the United States. One is they're determined to have lost all brain function, so they're considered brain dead. Or more commonly, people's heart stops and they're declared dead on the basis of cardiac failure or cardiac arrest. In both those cases, the primacy of the dying patient and that patient's family, it cannot be violated. And in my experience, it is not violated. Patients and their families come first. But the medical system can do a lot of good, and organ procurement organizations do a lot of good by highlighting for those families who've gone through a terrible loss the possibility for a silver lining to come from it. So once those decisions have been made and someone is truly dead and that loss has occurred, there may still be opportunity for that family to give the gift of life to other families and to have something good come from their terrible loss.
And we're almost up on a break here, but so keep them on life supports? I mean, even though they're dead?
Well, sometimes that happens, certainly in the case of people who are declared dead on the basis of their brain death. That's exactly what happens. We don't call it life support in that situation for obvious reasons, but it's necessary to preserve the functioning of their organs.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Scott Halpern. He's a medical ethicist, a pulmonologist. We're talking about the medical ethics involved with organ donation, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
With aortic stenosis, a few steps can leave you breathless. But for many older patients, open heart surgery is too risky. Now, St. Mary offers a new way, the TAVR technique. Instead of opening the chest, a new valve is threaded through a small incision in the leg. Less trauma, less risk, and faster recovery than open heart surgery. 215-710-5888. St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, supporting WHYY. It's your health. Expect more.
On the next Fresh Air, why the Lyme disease infection rate is growing, and so is the battle over how to treat it. We talk with Michael Spector about his article, The Lyme Wars, in the current edition of The New Yorker. He'll also tell us what's recommended if you find a tick on your body or your child's that might be carrying Lyme. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the Supreme Court rules on gay marriage. Also, a Holocaust survivor remembers his trip on a Kinder transport to America.
It was obviously emotionally upsetting to me and to my brother, Joe, who was 8 at the time. And I, being the 6-year-old, was the worst of the two of us.
Next time on Here and Now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Scott Halpern about some of the medical ethical issues involved in organ donation, why there's a shortage, and what can be done about it. And it looks like our phones have just exploded at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me see what Ajay from Graduate Hospital has to say. Ajay, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'm driving, so I hope you guys can hear me. But the question was more to Dr. Halpern. I'm actually a physician. I'm a donor. And I find that a lot of times perhaps there needs to be better education of those on the front line when it comes to organ procurement from the standpoint of, for example, trainees or house staff. And I was wondering if he could comment on what's being done for that, because sometimes there's some confusion as goals of care change from sort of active care to, you know, refocusing towards organ procurement.
It's a good question, Ajay. Thanks for and go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Jay. I think there is an increasing awareness of the importance of good end-of-life communication. And increasingly, certainly in my practice, I find that that's one area of medicine that a little bit gun-shy about, you know, leaving to trainees. I certainly include trainees in that process and hope that they can model really effective end-of-life communication so that both patients and their families are supported through a terrible process, and perhaps also that donation can be a possibility. This is a complicated undertaking. It's not like putting an IV in a vein. This is something that takes years of practice, and I think we need to embrace it as a community of medical specialists.
I would think it's important to have a relationship with this family as well.
Certainly, and that's something that occasionally people working in ICUs who are dealing with patients who are dying haven't had the opportunity to foster. Certainly, anything that physicians can do to build trust, to be transparent early in the course of a patient's ICU stay, can make these subsequent conversations that are invariably going to be difficult at least a bit easier.
Let me see what Vernon from Valley Forge has to say. Vernon, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is what we're talking about is a medical procedure. It's surgery. And I had the impression that the donor's family would get a bill following this procedure. And I'm wondering if that's correct.
Vernon, I'm glad you called. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for raising that question. I think it's another common misperception, but it's a good question to raise, and I think it's an important one for us to correct. Absolutely not. That could not be further from the truth. There are no additional costs to the donor or his or her family as a result of choosing to become an organ donor.
And no ambiguity there?
No, none whatsoever. It's all paid for by the organ procurement organizations.
Vernon, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What about making organs in the lab? Are we there yet? And I'm assuming in this brave new world that we live in, that's probably something on the horizon.
I certainly think it can happen. I wouldn't say that anything couldn't happen at this point, but we're not there yet, as you said, Marty. Hopefully, we will eventually have that technological solution to the mismatch between supply and demand. I don't know when exactly that might be.
Let me see what Hugh from Warminster has to say. And Hugh, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
My wife had a serious lung problem. We were on the transplant list. They wouldn't allow me to give her one of my lungs, which I didn't know before this, that you can't have a live donor. And I looked into the process extensively. I talked with former Congressman Bob Edgar, who died recently.
Oh, sure.
And he said that back in 1985, he had introduced legislation to change the way we do things, kind of reverse the whole process, that you would be a donor unless you opted out of being a donor, instead of how we do it, where you have to specifically state that you're a donor. And this is done in many Western European countries, according to him. And he said that the bill got nowhere, and it was because of the strong religious opposition to it.
Hugh, thanks for
the
call. Yeah, thanks for the call, Hugh. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, it's a great point, Hugh. So there have been many people over the years who've been promoting, and in fact, there are still many people who do promote this opt-out system that you mentioned, whereby people would be organ donors unless or until they signed a card to say that they didn't want to be. So the model here is that the same choices would be present. You could be an organ donor or not. You're simply changing the default of what you would be if you didn't take an active intervention. So I think it's a good idea. Certainly, as you noted, there are some many Western European countries that have this model. And there's some suggestion that they have much higher donation rates than the United States. A couple caveats there are that there are lots of things that are different between Western European countries and the United States, so it may not just be the switch in the default that's being operative here, but it may be a big part of it. The Institute of Medicine has actually considered this proposal several times, most recently, as far as I know, in 2006, and they too thought that this was a virtuous proposal. The concern they had, and I think it's a good one, is that in such a large and variegated society such as the United States, it would be difficult to make everyone aware that a decision was being made, to give them the opportunity to opt out if they wanted to. That might be less of a problem in a smaller nation such as Spain or other countries that have such a policy. So I think it's worth pursuing, but I'm not sure that we've ironed out all the wrinkles.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. As you said that, I'm thinking about how much people don't know, for instance, about the Affordable Care Act, which was passed into law. I mean, there's just a great amount of misunderstanding or even ignorance about the law.
That's right. And I think the concern is that we don't want to be making these decisions for people without them being aware of it.
What about buying and selling organs? I know we have talked about this, Scott, in the past, but how do we fold that into our conversation?
Well, I think, as you know, I'm an advocate not of starting to buy and sell organs, and for sure this only applies to kidneys, but I'm an advocate of at least considering, of at least testing a system in which people could be compensated for going through the trials and tribulations of giving one of their two kidneys to someone else. Well over 80% of people who are waiting an organ in this country are waiting for a kidney. It's the biggest mismatch between supply and demand by a long shot. And the virtues for both patients and society of more patients getting off dialysis and getting a kidney transplantation are tremendous. There are a lot of legitimate concerns with this practice. There are concerns that people will be blinded to the risks of the procedure. There are concerns that it'll only be poor people who are motivated by money. All of those concerns are fair, but I think we should test the process to see if those concerns actually manifest. And if they do, then we should not go forward with it. But it may be that our instincts are wrong. They've certainly been wrong on a lot of other important issues of our time.
And how would you test it?
Well, I think what we'd have to do is to have a geographically defined region, one donor service area or a couple contiguous regions, where we would implement a process whereby people within, and to be clear, this would only be something within a country. Not, we don't want a situation where people are going abroad and buying organs from impoverished nations and then coming back. That's a clear power dynamic that fails a lot of ethical measures. But within a certain country, within a defined region, we could implement a policy where people are compensated, and in fact, they could be compensated quite handsomely and have it still be less expensive than the expenses of that the country's already paying for dialysis. And just see what happens, see who we recruit to be organ donors and see what the risks to these people really are and how they think about those decisions. That's really the importance. We don't want anyone being blinded or manipulated by money. We want people to be making well-informed decisions. But I think it's a little bit paternalistic to say that people can't make well-informed decisions if they're being paid. And that's what the medical community has adopted as its standpoint right now.
Well, I do want to get back to our callers, throwing that issue into the mix as well. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have Chris from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Doctor. I'm a live donor. 2 years ago, I gave my wife a kidney.
Wow.
She's doing great now, successful, and I'm none the worse for the wear. And I just like to, throw it out, out there that it wasn't the procedure isn't as invasive as it used to be, and I was out of the hospital in a few days, and I couldn't lift anything heavy for a year. But I'm back to my old self, and none the worse for the wear. And my wife has a new lease.
And she has a new lease on her life as well, Chris.
Yeah. Her kidneys were failing. She was on dialysis for, I guess, a year and a half.
Well, that's just wonderful, Chris. I mean, if there were more people who were willing to undergo that, then we wouldn't need to contemplate paying people. We certainly wouldn't need to contemplate a variety of other strategies that don't have entirely good mm-hmm. sides and have some downsides to them. So I couldn't be more thrilled for your decision and would hope that other people can learn from your experience.
Yeah, what a great gift to give to somebody. Chris, thank you so much for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Trish from Yardley has to say. Trish, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. My question is this. I'm a malignant melanoma survivor. That was 30 years ago. And now I'm type 1 diabetic. So am I a candidate for donating?
Hmm. And what would you want to donate?
Well, I don't know. Whatever they would want, possibly. Type 1 diabetics sometimes eventually have kidney problems and eye problems, other problems. I every year when I renew my registration or license, I always want to say I'm a donator. But I was told several years ago as a malignant melanoma survivor, they wouldn't want anything from me. So I just want to know if the technology has changed, if I would be if I could donate something.
Well, Trish, let's find out. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, typically, first I should say that it's probably not the best situation to be opining on a specific individual's case, but usually you're correct that people who've survived melanoma, which is a pretty dangerous skin cancer, as you know, and I'm glad to hear you've done so well. And people with at least advanced stages of diabetes would not be considered donors. But going back to what we were talking about before, I think we need to at least reconsider some of our traditional exclusion criteria from donation if we have society's best interests in mind.
Thanks for calling in, Trish. Let's get Howard Nathan to join us on Radio Times. He's the CEO of Gift for Life. And Howard Nathan, it's been many years. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Hi, Howie.
What would you like to tell us?
Well, I just wanted to reiterate the fact that the real issues that started the conversation about allocation of organs really stems back to the need. And you talked about that. Right now, just in our region, there's 6,500 people waiting for an organ transplant and 120,000 nationwide. And what I did want to say is that in the Gift of Life region, which is the eastern half of the state of Pennsylvania, South Jersey, and Delaware, we've had more organ donations here than anywhere else in the United States for the past decade.
Wow.
And the reason is that we try to make sure that the public is aware through, not only the driver's license program, but a lot of public ed. And one of your callers talked about physician education, and we try to do do that in all 130 hospitals that we cover. And I think it's a tribute to the families who have given, in addition to those families who are living donors, families that, you know, give the gift of life while they're still alive. And there's a lot of examples of that throughout our region. We're just proud of that. We wanted to make sure that the public knew that the real issue is to make sure that they and their family sign up to be a donor.
Well, Howard Nathan, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, the CEO of Gift for Life. Scott, looks like you want to say something.
No, I just wanted to add, Howie, that I think a lot of the success story goes to you and the tireless efforts that you and your organization have had on behalf of people in our region. So thanks to you.
We began by talking about 10-year-old Sarah Murnahan, and we also talked with Kathy Clapham, who had a lung transplantation with cystic fibrosis, and she's doing quite well raising her two children. And I'm wondering, with children getting a lung transplantation, about what that recovery is like. I'm assuming it's different for every child, but are there certain benchmarks that you as a pulmonologist would be looking for?
Well, as you said, every patient is different. And as we were talking about earlier, most patients are off the breathing machine quickly. Mm-hmm. We probably shouldn't talk about the specific details of Sarah's case to maintain her privacy. But she, it's certainly possible that she's going to have a long road ahead. I think we need to be mindful, and people who are undergoing or agreeing to be candidates for transplantation need to be mindful that although it can be an absolute magic bullet and be a lifesaver for a number of people, sometimes it's a process of trading one disease for another. And not everyone has as smooth sailing as Kathy has had after the procedure. That doesn't mean that it's not worth doing, and we should continue to improve our medical technology to make more people be as successful as Kathy has been.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times. Scott Halpern, a medical ethicist, assistant professor of medicine, medical ethics, health policy, and epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we also spoke with Kathy Clapham, and she's an advocate for organ donation and volunteers with Gift of Life. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and join our conversation on Facebook. You can also check us out follow us on Twitter as well. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.